Bienvenidos a Data Latam, donde exploramos la industria de datos en Latinoamérica.
Muy buenas, Franz, ¿cómo estás?
Muy buenas, Diego, muy bien, muchísimas gracias. ¿Tú cómo estás?
Bien, entusiasmado. Tengo muchas ganas, tal vez para cuando salga este podcast esto habrá pasado, pero estamos yendo a Colombia pronto
Sí.
y muchas ganas de estar allá en esas tierras.
Oh, y todo este concepto del Expantia Roadshow, ya lo hemos hecho varias veces, pero siempre es divertido. Tengo muchas ganas de ver con quiénes nos vamos a conocer en Colombia. Y hay muchos que tú conoces, que tú y yo conocemos ya, ¿no? Entonces, visitar amigos, clientes, colegas, va a ser muy divertido.
Sí, definitivamente. Y creo que, y sobre todo por este podcast en particular, el conectar con gente que está en distintas áreas, pero asociadas a lo que es innovar con tecnología y datos, es siempre interesante. Hoy tenemos la suerte de hablar con alguien que es un experto en lo que es apoyar a empresas en diseñar y desarrollar sistemas de software. Y en Phoenix, ¿no? Que es un área que estamos cubriendo bastante. Así que, dado que esto va a ser en inglés, ¿y te parece si pasamos a inglés en este momento? ¿Qué decís?
Me parece muy bien para los que están escuchando y dicen, uy, inglés. Siempre hay un resumen en español en la descripción del podcast que te puede ayudar a seguir la conversación. Entonces, por favor, no desistas porque la conversación va a estar buena.
So, shall we say now, hi friends, how are you? No, no,
No, no, no,
no.
no,
Go
no.
again.
Hi, Chad. It's so good to have you on the podcast. Great to see you here.
Hi guys, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Most
Oh,
welcome.
thank you for the time, Chad. And look, we usually start this by asking you to tell the audience where are you exactly at this point, and what do you do? And then we get to the rest. But if you can start with
Perfect.
that.
Yes. So I am located in lovely Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States, and have been here for 25 years. I started my life in the northern part of the United States, in Wisconsin, and graduated from college there and moved out to the desert. And it's absolutely fantastic out here, obviously, with the wonderful weather we have this time of year and all of the great events and everything like that.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. And look, as we go to the next phase, which is what is that you do? Let me quickly go through your background as I can read it in LinkedIn. And I'm going to really summarize that so that you can then add color, correct whatever I say wrong. But super quickly, you've had an amazing career in software development and QA, software QA. Then moved to VP of engineering and then product management. You went through operations as well, and then product and strategy. So, product, software, and really being able to ensemble teams that can develop successfully software products and maintain them is what you've done. If I see that correctly, you passed through some bigger companies, but usually not huge corporations. You like more the ecosystem of companies around the 500 to 1,000 people. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I found my niche in a lot smaller companies because we were able to do a lot more things hands-on. There was less meetings, there was less overhead and red tape, and we were able to, as engineers, think about ideas, strategize about how we do them, and we'd be more empowered to actually deliver those to life. So, yes, I started out my career as an engineer, QA and software development. I was not the world's greatest software developer. So unlike Franz, I was trained in all of that, but I found myself looking at the reasons why were we coding it like this? What were we doing? And trying to constantly talk about the business use case. And so I found myself a very natural fit to become a team leader where I got to manage teams and make them more efficient. And then I found my way to product management, which is obviously the perfect blend of what is the business problem to be solved and what are the technologies we're going to use. And so I have been effectively in that role for quite some time. And I am more technical than a lot of your typical product managers that have maybe come up from the business side. But I find that the blend of that what are we trying to do with our business, and what type of software and technology can we use to further that mission is really just the best way to spend my time during the day.
All this career brought you to co-founding Disca, right? So why don't you talk about Disca? What is it? What you guys do, such that the audience has the complete background?
Yeah, so my two partners, Sean and Aaron, and I founded Disca late 2020, and we started working on it officially in 2021. I had actually hired Aaron to my team back probably about 10 years ago at a cybersecurity company that we were working at. I left that company, Sean joined, and then I hired them both when I worked for a digital agency. And they are very technical in their skill sets. Aaron is our software architect and data strategist, usually, and visionary. And Sean actually is one of the best DevOps and infrastructure architects I've literally ever seen. And so between the three of us, it was our passion to go out and innovate and to help people solve problems. One of the things that we saw in kind of deciding to start our business was that a lot of people were spending a lot of money with consultants and offshore development and all of those kinds of things, and weren't necessarily seeing the value. And a lot of that was through the disconnect of what they needed to do as a business or what their software was supposed to do and what the software was built to do. And it wasn't necessarily that the engineering was bad or that the software development was bad, but the development and the business problem weren't meeting together. And so we really strive as a small software consultancy, we really strive to work with people who don't necessarily have these skill sets in-house. They don't have somebody who can help define a system so that it's efficient with their business. We work with them. And then in a lot of cases, we work hand in hand with them to actually design and build these systems and operate and maintain them from time to time as well. And that's where we partner with companies like Expantia to bring in, when we need it, the deep expertise in some of these areas. I had a sales call this morning with one of my peers here in the Phoenix area who is an expert at designing user experience. We're pitching a mutual prospect together, and I picked him because he's the best at what he does. And so we open the door to our clients to work with experts such as yourselves when the need arises and when they can make good use of that.
Fantastic, fantastic. And this is a data podcast, right? So one of the things we wanted to explore is, what are the kind of data challenges that A, you face in your career, right? As you were doing product development and you were in software development and doing what you were doing in different companies. And then what are the data challenges that you find today with this kind of customers with which you are developing or helping them develop these solutions?
Sure. So one of my first really big data challenges was I was one of the engineering executives at a video streaming company. And this was 10 or 15 years ago. And our small startup had just been acquired by a larger publicly traded company. And I was in charge of customer billing. And back then we had our players would actually be embedded and would give us all of this data on clicks, plays, views, all of those kinds of things. And it would enter into this massive data lake. So if you're old enough to think back 10 or 15 years ago and you were working back then, the tools back then were not like the tools we have today. The capacity in the cloud back then was not like today. So we actually had on-premises compute that ran a Hadoop cluster that processed billions of bits of data every single month. And we were constantly under the Under the thumb of our CEO, when is the billing going to be done? Because this was literally our revenue generation and everything, right? So that was one of the first big challenges. And my team in Seattle was absolutely fantastic. Two data scientists up there and a whole bunch of helpers that helped figure this out and really brute force this process time and time again. Back where I met Aaron, we worked for one of the first ideas of a security operations platform for SOX back in the mid 2010s. And the challenge of getting all of the data that we were gathering and monitoring, and we're monitoring systems and looking at all of the threat data that was coming in and different things like that. Again, think back almost 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, we had AWS and we utilized that, but there wasn't the levels of expanding and collapsing that there are today. It was obviously more expensive. And the tools and techniques just wasn't there. So that company went through a lot of iterations and eventually now is part of Fortinet, which obviously is a big security company. But just thinking about all of the data that could come from all of those different places, putting it in and making it available and understandable for, at the time, a lot of manual people watching screens reacting to different threat environments. The problem that we're seeing today with DISCA is we work with a lot of small and medium-sized businesses. Those businesses are largely doing things on Excel or have data that they're creating or is part of their business, but that they're not even capturing or that they're not even understanding the business value of. So in many cases, even if you're a small, let's say you are a small shop that does plumbing and things like that, you buy from suppliers. Those suppliers would love to know what your needs are for pipes and fittings and valves and things ahead of time so that they can work through their supply chain and supply you with those different items at just the right time. There's a lot of people who are going through their business, and these are successful businesses that are making a lot of money. They don't really even understand where the data is, where it could be used, or what that value is. And so in a lot of cases, we spend some time obviously designing software platforms and talking about different technologies, but we talk about what data is available to them to consume, what data they're producing, and then how that data could actually start to expand the story of their business.
So Chad, in your role, given the fact that you've been closer to business, right? Understanding business challenges and translating that to technology. What is it like if you compare maybe 10 years ago to now, and especially for small and medium business? Because I think that perhaps is where the biggest changes have taken place, right?
They have, and it's about availability. It's about availability of tools and the, in a certain way, almost the productization of some of these various tools. And, take examples like low-code tools, Airtable, Rose, different things like that. So there's already some advantages to people who aren't locked into these Excel spreadsheets that they've been keeping around for several years and home growing their formulas and all of that kind of stuff. They can automatically look at one of these new platforms and start doing new and better things with their data than they were able to do before. We've made tools that the average smart person can go in, spend a couple of hours, maybe they'll watch some YouTube videos or see something online and be able to come in and start solving some of those problems or connecting their systems. I can't tell you how many small businesses I work with that have HubSpot and Zapier, and this is their data stack, basically, is they have these very accessible but relatively crude tools, and they're taking data here, moving it there, and have workflows and pipelines to take some of those things. So I think the biggest change is just the availability of tools, the access to tools that are relatively cheap, and then also this idea that business owners are thinking more and more beyond just what their business is, and they're done trying to have manual processes. They don't. No small business that I've talked to in the last 6 months is looking to necessarily cut staff. They're looking to take the staff that they have, the employees that they have, and make them better and more efficient and do more valuable work than manual data input or wrestling around with some of the old technology. And in many cases, they're willing to invest in new technology because that gives them the foundation to then leverage the AI tools and machine learning and other modern things that a lot of other, especially larger businesses, already enjoy.
Nice. I wonder what has been the reaction over the past year or so for some of your customers on these ChatGPT, LLMs? Have you seen them ask, what can we do? What is, I don't know, have you seen any difference over the past year?
Absolutely. There's, in many cases, there's a lot of curiosity. And these, a lot of our clients are running successful businesses and doing things like that. So a lot of their time and attention is already going in this direction to running their business. They don't have a lot of free time to experiment around. But we have had clients that are starting to feed their PDFs into chatbots and trying to do a lot of these things that aren't necessarily new, right? It's OCR and then taking that, turning it into text and processing the text through different workflows. But because those tools, 3 to 5 years ago were a lot more specialized and took a lot more technical know-how to maybe hook together, now this is new and novel because all they have is one interface and a $20 a month subscription, and they're able to do these magical things with data. And when you're dealing with somebody who is an expert in their industry, they've been working in that industry for 10 or 20 years and they know the people and know the industry really well. They start to think about these tools and they start to think about some of this data and the processes that they're going through, and it unlocks new ways of thinking or new ways that they think they can work with the data. And that's really, I mean, this is the call that I had earlier today was literally they own a landscape company and they have all of these ideas about management of their workflows and resources and benefits to their clients. And there are today multiple people that are manually doing some of these jobs. He's not at all interested in getting rid of those people. He's interested in repurposing their jobs and upskilling them and getting them more involved in different areas and away from some of this manual analysis that they're doing today.
Yeah, it's something common to what we see in some of the startups we work with in the US or organizations, the idea of empowering or giving, making people or processes much more efficient and productive is something that we've seen. And data innovation, sometimes it may be a high-end model that can predict something or can do something sophisticated. Some other times it's using data to optimize a lot of what is being done. On that end, the other question I have is, when you faced these interests, right, from customers that are trying to do more with their data, do you find any pattern on whether this is more focused on the commercial side and sales data, or is it more on the operations type data? I don't know. Is there any pattern that you've found, or it depends on the customers that you're talking to?
It's both, and it depends on the customers that we're talking to. And so the on the more operations side, I mean, we've talked a little bit about that and how manual work can go away and how we can make connections to things. We've talked to clients about leveraging in some systems they have hardware sensors or hardware infrastructure that's part of their system, gathering up the data in a sensical way from those different endpoints and sensors and triangulating it. Anything and depending on sort of the situation too. One of our clients is involved actually in data management, and they do some work with some of the larger utilities here in the United States. They are responsible for characterizing some maintenance functionality and predicting like a mean time to failure of critical infrastructure is an absolute use case that their clients are interested in. In other cases, especially with we have a client who is it's a staffing company. They put educators and teachers to work. They're very interested in optimizing the quote unquote the sales process and making sure that they're as efficient as they can with the supply of teachers that they have and placing them in roles that that make sense for them. So there's definitely a mix of all different types of data uses. One of the more interesting conversations I've had in the past couple of months is really a gentleman who works in a very specific industry who is well known in that industry and well connected, but really wants to aggregate the data of himself and his competitors and make sort of a new subscription model for their industry-centric data. I thought that was an absolutely visionary idea from somebody who doesn't have a background in data or data science or engineering, has just been doing the job for the last 15, 20 years, and has this idea that if we bring this data together, it benefits the suppliers, it benefits the end clients, and it benefits the solution providers in the middle. And so it is really on a case-by-case basis, but it's what makes part of my role so exciting is we get to find out about all of these new use cases and then work with those individual clients for their needs to figure out how to maximize this opportunity that they've identified.
So, Chad, you mentioned something there that I find particularly interesting myself, and that is the data landscape as such is changing, right? And especially for SMEs. So the amount and the quality of data that we can access, some freely, some paid through some service, is changing radically. Is that something that you see in the ask that your customers have when they're standing at your door? Are they aware of this, or is this something that you need to make them aware of?
Again, it depends. Some of them actually are aware of industry data that or relevant data to them that they might plug in. And some of it is even there's databases of industry contacts, like for salespeople and things like that. I have a very good friend who's in sales, and we had a whole conversation about just making efficient and effective use of that kind of list within the process of his normal prospecting and everything like that. Sometimes there is a lot of knowledge, especially if somebody is pretty industrious in their industry and has figured a bunch of these things out, or they network and talk and find this data. Sometimes it's not necessarily apparent where the data is. Sometimes, as in the case of we have a client whose main focus is helping school districts here in Arizona, in the US, process their annual financial reports. There is public data available The state of Arizona makes that public that data available publicly, but it's a complete mess to get to. Very difficult to get to. You have to download it in CSVs, I think. It's really, really awful. And it's not a ready-made database that you can access with an API or that's even searchable or filterable very easily. And of course, all of the different data is in all different places, and it's not a one-stop shop for data. So that availability of data certainly varies by industry and by function, but sometimes people are becoming aware, and it's not just demographics. It's not just, 25-year-old people that are coming in and saying, "Oh, I know all about this data." These are 50 and 60-year people, 30, 40 years working, that are thinking about data. So the myth that if you've been in your career, you're locked out of this, that's simply not the case. We've seen as many younger people and younger business owners and younger professionals talking about data as we have the more experienced.
Well, you just mentioned, Chad, is an interesting case. You talked about the one with the public schools and where they were coming from and the type of data that they had access to. And then could you dive a bit there on how the project started and then how it evolves and what kind of tools are or yeah platforms are involved in that?
Yeah, this is a great story. So our client works with one of the school districts here, and he has a technical background and became more on the finance and business side, if you will, of the schools over the years. He thinks the processes are bad. He hates the Excel spreadsheets, and he said there has to be a better way. And so for a lot of years, he's been, as an engineer, of course, trying to rig the system and get around all the stuff that he didn't want to do. And so he's developed these hacks, if you will, to get his work done as accurately as it needs to be done, but a lot quicker and more agnostic to these tools that he's given, which are Excel spreadsheets. By the way, these are 2003 Excel spreadsheets, XLS. They're not even anything modern whatsoever. And so we started talking about this vision that he had, and basically to process these files, you take the general ledger from the school district and you run it through algorithms and processes. This is both data validation as well as then data normalization to prep it for these particular reports. And his idea is, well, if I can collect all of this data that the state gets, but I can collect it and I can normalize it and put it in a format that makes sense and make it then back available to the clients that we're serving, this is a bonus. There's a particular report that these files are due in October, and this report is basically a how did you spend your money report that comes out in March. He was able to help us make the software to create this report at the time that you're submitting your annual report. So 6 months before the state produces your report, you have a good idea. And of course, there's some debate always about particular expenses and if they were coded as this or coded as that or those kinds of things. So it's not 100% accurate, but it at least gives a very good sense following their rules of what that is. And so his vision is if we help people fill out these forms and we're starting to gather the data, then we can do stuff with the data, right? So we can do simple things like start identifying trend lines and just operational things for the schools. But then, of course, we got to thinking about Well, how valuable is this for vendors, people who cut grass at schools or supply schools with food or materials and textbooks and different things like that? They would like to know, especially when it comes to schools that are looking to maybe build a new school or renovate existing schools, and they'll know, who they can contact. And then this is a product that's a modular product, and so there's different modules associated with the product. One of the products was a collaboration with Arizona State University to do predictive analysis on populations and try to understand how many kids are aging out of school, how many are coming into the district, how many are will potentially be enrolled for the upcoming school year. And so there's some algorithms as well as some machine learning that's happening, aggregating a whole bunch of statistics and then looking at things like real estate data and census data to really understand what's happening with the demographics. And then we're getting now into the budgeting part. And so his ideal world is to start, connecting budgets with expenses and, making that process a lot more interesting with some of the more modern machine learning and AI tools.
Interesting. And we've seen this pattern, right? I think starting with some maybe basic need to automate things that are boring or that are there. But then that opens the eyes to different opportunities, as you described now, and more being able to use then machine learning to do even more interesting stuff. But I think it's always this phased approach, right? And yeah, fantastic case study. If I can ask, which are the tools and platforms and technologies that you're seeing being used, either for these projects or in general?
Yeah, so we start off really just using some very basic tools. So we've really started making use of graph databases quite frequently in our projects. That's pretty much a given. There are certain databases that we're using for different applications, and I think the key for a lot of our clients is they're willing to invest, but they're also conscious of the ongoing costs and things like that. So more than the specific tools, it can be a question of what do I need now? Because I only want to spend a certain amount versus how much could I or what could we expand to later? And so a lot of times we're starting off small, just using those tools that are appropriate for that particular project. It's really interesting that we've, as a small company ourselves, started to really rely on open source projects and freemium type projects, right? So Red Hat obviously pioneered this way back in the day, but Apache has a number of data management tools that we're taking advantage of. So we dip into the Apache stack a bit for some of those basic needs. Some of the we use Google Cloud, and Google Cloud has some analysis tools as well as data tools too. And we've made obviously use of AWS and some of its infrastructure. A lot of AI, there is a partner company that we have that's doing a lot of AI innovation, but in some cases, and in most cases, even for to get started, just plugging in ChatGPT is something that's very appropriate for some of the experimental stuff and some of the lightweight things. But the key with a lot of our clients is they understand that software is a big investment, and they're thinking, short term and long term. And Once they've decided to make that investment, they're okay with it as long as all of those costs can be justified. The infrastructure client makes heavy use of Oracle and their entire suite of database management tools, just because of mainly because it handles the scale of what they're doing very, very well. But that is a solution that's way too expensive and way too complicated for a lot of our SMB clients. Not a lot of them stick with the very basic no code, low code tools very long, but they're also scared to go up into the stratosphere of some of those other tools. So it's usually a conversation that's driven by cost and availability, and it's really a value conversation that we have with a lot of our solutions.
Yeah, similar approach and that we use, and usually we like, of course, understanding the customer, what they need, what they have in budget, what they actually need to solve, and then bringing a hybrid between what some cloud vendors offer, but also open source solutions, as you described. I think we're pretty aligned. Anything that you would add to that, Franz, that on the way in which we sometimes approach these type of projects?
I think the key, it's not a trick, but the key thing to be very aware of, that whatever you propose needs to align with the culture and the capabilities of the customer you're working with. Right, but it's very little sense to propose something that is way beyond their capabilities, or on the other hand, something that is they could do, but it's not theirs. You know, it's not what they usually do, and that's sometimes a difficult balance, Chad. I'm sure you recognize where that's not always so clearly defined, depending on who you're talking to.
Absolutely, it is, and most clients are very prepared to have that conversation. There's been very few people that we've talked to that are unaware that technology is expensive. And those costs can sometimes be moved around, but there is some tangible cost that's involved in the ongoing maintenance and sustainability. And if there's, you know, excessive license fees or those types of things, or a very structured tiered approach to growth, that's a lot less attractive in a lot of cases. And so that's 100% right. And again, a lot of these companies don't have this facility or this capacity internally to even manage the software. And so they do need some additional help from the outside. And a generalist, let's say, who is well versed on all tools is way more affordable than that twice or three times certified specialist that you need to run some of the more complex tools.
Hey, we have usually two more questions, Chad, that I would love to get both you, Franz, our perspective on this. One is, how do you see data and AI impacting your customer SMBs, as you mentioned, as well as us all? Is there anything, any trend, any pattern, anything that you usually think of?
Yeah, well, I'll throw back to my cybersecurity days and start talking here about bad data. Bad data or suspicious data, fake news, as it's been called here in the US a lot, maybe the past couple of years. Bad data is dangerous. And I think that is the theme. We all are trained as people to see, you know, the happy path and to see, you know, opportunity with things that are presented to us. But not all data is real data. Not all data is good data. Data is incomplete. Data might be wrong. Data might be in the wrong units, especially if we're translating between here in Costa Rica, pounds and kilograms even. And so we need to be very careful with data. And I think that is the implication that data and AI has. The impact is obviously that there's going to be a lot of really good impacts as far as efficiency and new breakthroughs and scientific advances and all of that kind of stuff. But if we have AI being trained on bad data or nefarious data, it could obviously be very, very bad. So I don't like to go into the negative and kind of take that approach, but it's always a cautious one for me to make sure that We're dealing with things that we can authenticate and that we know are good data sets and complete data sets and not something that could be bad.
Yeah. Models can be as good as the data, and think about the type of data quality. I completely agree. And then the last question, Chad. We usually like asking people like you that are involved in executing projects or doing interesting stuff with data, and in this case, in collaboration with different type of customers. You need to stay aware of what's going on. So what is it? What are your mechanisms to be in the state of the art? Which are the ways in which you keep up to date? Do you talk to people? Do you go to conferences? What are your mechanisms?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been fortunate to develop a really strong network throughout my career. And I certainly recommend that to everybody, is to stay close to people that you have a general good vibe in, and expect that you'll be giving to that relationship likely more than you'll be taking. But going back to my cybersecurity days, I've made a lot of relationships with people who are now consultants and buried kind of deep into that. And I find that they have a lot of very interesting insights on, I feel like cybersecurity is really kind of in a lot of ways on the cutting edge and innovating in a lot of data science, as well as, data management, AI, machine learning, and those kinds of things. And so people who work not only for services companies, but product companies that are creating some of the well-known tools and apparatuses that are used have really, really good insight. I'm a particular fan of Bar Moses. She's the CEO of Monte Carlo. They have a data observability platform, and the things that she talks about just kind of harkens back to my last comments around complete data and good data and, authenticating, knowing the source, all those kinds of things. She's got a background with, the Israeli military and things like that. Kind of a place where a lot of those cybersecurity professionals come from. But just some really, really interesting insights along those lines. And in dealing with who we deal with, we get to work with 8 to 10 clients at a time. We're also seeing all of the things that are happening with them and in their industries as well. And that spans B2B, B2C, across a number of different industries. So they are actually really good at kind of keeping us up to date with things that they've heard or things that apply to their businesses.
Yeah, nothing like customers and good problems to solve, to keep learning, right?
Right.
Fantastic, fantastic. Chad, it has been a pleasure. We usually keep this to 40 minutes, but we could continue talking for a while. Look, thanks for the time. Continued success for what you're doing, the cool project you're working on with Sean and Aaron, with your customers there. And thanks for the time. I hope we can do an update session maybe in 1 or 2 years to see what's new in these projects and what's happening with data.
That would certainly be a lot of fun. Thank you both for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, bye, thank you, Chad.
Bye-bye now.
Gracias por acompañarnos en nuestra exploración del mundo de ciencia de datos en este Data Latam Podcast. Cada 2 semanas encontrarás un nuevo episodio en datalatam.com o iTunes. Si te gustó este podcast, déjanos comentarios en Facebook.